Ever wanted to hang out with a bunch of Sanrio characters like Hello Kitty, Kuromi, and Cinema Roll? Well, you can with Hello Kitty Island Adventure, available on Apple Arcade. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Is there an invisible hand of design behind some of the moments that you're in? Because I know that I got into some pretty dicey scrapes, and I'm just wondering, how much do you influence what happens versus is it just pure luck?
It's funny how often people think that I might be cheating the dice rolls. The human brain has a way of narrativizing absolutely everything. There's a reason we use dice in tabletop games so much, and that's because they have this incredible ability to tell a story. Even if you just roll 3 threes in a row, that seems like it means something. The stress design is so effective to me because it asks the player to set their limit. And you will naturally slot into your kind of tension spot. You know, the lowest, apart from the glitch dice, the lowest dice in the game are a coin flip. Almost everybody, hopefully everybody who plays through Sit and Sleeper has at least one moment where they're like, oh my God, it's gone horribly wrong.
Sifter.com.au.
Hello and welcome to Lightmap from Sifter, our video game interview show. I'm Gianni DiGiovanni. Today, we welcome back Gareth Damian Martin to the show and step out into the stars with Citizen Sleeper 2 Starwood Vector, follow-up to that hit sci-fi game that I fell in love with. Before we jump into that, here's what's been making news this week on Walkthrough, Sifter's weekly news podcast. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Kyle Paletto.
And I'm Fiona Bartholomaeus.
And here are the top stories this week on Walkthrough, Sifter's weekly news podcast for Sunday, 23rd of March.
LEGO Pokemon sets are coming as Nintendo announces a new collaboration.
Microsoft shares a look at the new UI of Xbox, but might have shared a bit too much as Steam icon appears.
US game developers come together to form the biggest industry-wide union, which is great news.
And we've got some pretty exciting news to share about Sifter as well.
You can get every episode of Walkthrough for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or on our website sifter.com.au every Sunday.
To Lightmap, interesting conversations with video game creators.
Citizen Sleeper was a special game. Role-playing science fiction at the mercy of a dice roll, it made you question the value of your own life and the lives of everyone around you in a crushing capitalist world that people would scrape and find their place, find their humanity, find their community. And it was a story that really stuck with me over the years. Now, Gareth Damian Martin joined Lightmap way back in the halcyon days of 2022, where hyper-powerful oligarchs had yet to discover that they could fully take over entire societies. Now we're in 2025, we join another sleeper as they awaken and find their place in the Starwood Belt. G'day, welcome back to the show.
Hey, happy to be here.
Now, it was a pretty exciting game at the time, and I'm really curious. When we last spoke, it was before the game had kind of come out. We were kind of expecting there might be a bit of reaction to it. Take me right back to that sort of post-launch moment of the first Citizen Sleeper.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it feels like a very long time ago to me, but yeah, I mean, I think it was slightly dizzying in the sense that I wasn't really sure how the game would land. And I think, you know, as a solo developer, you have certain expectations that, you know, you expect to be smaller than other games generally anyway. So I think the response to Citizen Sleeper was kind of, it was quite striking, especially just the number of people. I think it was more than the critical response, just the number of people who kind of started sending me messages and started kind of contacting me or talking to me, and it kind of slowly dawned on me really over the course of like doing many interviews and things and podcasts and things like this, where people would come on and they would immediately tell me how much they loved the game as the first thing that they wanted to say to me. And I just never had that experience before. So it was, yeah, it was quite a striking experience the first time around.
You know, it's interesting when you make something creative, it can almost feel like when you move on to your next thing, it's trying to capture that lightning in a bottle. But I also know that a lot of creators think, okay, I can't just go and repeat the same steps. So I'm curious, what was the decision behind making a direct sequel to that game and actually continuing that story and continuing that world?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, yeah, I'm not really a kind of, I almost surprised myself with the idea that I wanted to make a sequel, because I think generally I really have too many ideas usually than I think I'll ever get a chance to make in my life. So the idea of kind of going back to another one is not something that I usually think about. But after doing Citizen Sleep 1 and then doing the DLC, which was my first step into kind of thinking about, well, this game's been successful and people really love it, and I still have so many more things that I think about it and so many more things that I think about the design and the structure and the storytelling, so many things I wanted to cover, but I didn't have time because the development period for Citizen Sleeper was relatively tight. It was 2 years, and it was intended as a relatively kind of short turnaround game. I don't think it's possible to make a game in much less than 2 years, although you can sometimes. But so for me, the DLC was a kind of attempt to play about with some ideas. And then I really felt at the end of the DLC, and it was kind of wrapping up, and I was thinking to myself, okay, I've got other ideas for games. I want to maybe move on to those. And I'd even begun pitching those to my publisher and discussing which one might be a good one to take forward. And then it just hit me that I just wasn't really done with the design and with the world in both cases. There were so many ideas I had from tabletop games that I wanted to see in a video game. And I kind of felt like if I went away from Citizen Sleeper, I don't know if I would ever come back. So it seemed like if I wanted the opportunity to kind of continue to contribute to what I thought was had become a really interesting and exciting discussion around the original game and around how tabletop games might influence video games like they did back when RPGs were kind of first invented on computers, it felt like there were things still to be said and things still to be done. And I had a more sophisticated and richer vision of also what a sleeper was and what the world was from having made something and then talking about it with people and thinking about it more and yeah, trying to widen that out. So it just felt like I had all of this material and all of these ideas. And so I once again set myself a kind of 2-year window to make a sequel, with the idea being that I would try to push the formula. I would want to make a companion piece to the original game, so that if people, you know, one of my objectives was kind of, if it's not such a big deal if people say they preferred the first one, as long as they also felt that the second one was valuable, I really wanted to make a game that would sit alongside it. So yeah, those were the kind of things that got me ending up committing to making a sequel.
I'm curious, where you just said there that you had a better idea about what a sleeper was. Now, sleeper are the kind of simulated people in some respects. Their bodies are sort of artificial, but their minds and I guess their souls are real. Can you tell me, over that period of time of making this game, how has the idea of what a sleeper is has changed up until where we are now in the second game?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was it's the difference between writing something instinctively and then writing something with maybe more of a kind of critical awareness of what something is. I think that's often the case when you move from an original to a sequel or move through a series. But really, when I sat down to write The Sleeper, it was kind of an idea that I'd had based around what I'd seen in kind of the gig economy, what I'd seen in kind of Uberization of work. And there was this kind of science fiction concept there. But I think also there was this desire I had to write about bodies in a very particular way, and write about, especially, you know, I've noticed that I have this obsession with kind of like waking up and the you know, I wrote the first scene of Citizen Sleeper 1 first. That was the first thing I ever wrote that was in Citizen Sleeper. And it's a scene about waking up and kind of slightly discovering that your body is not really your body, or finding, negotiating your way into existence. And I think I realized, you know, after having written that from a very instinctive perspective and just kind of having got that down, I think having made a whole game and then discussed it with people, I felt like I kind of understood that sleeper the sleeper had been invented as a way to talk about humans more than it was to talk about AI or robots, which is not something that I particularly interest me. I'll be honest, even though all the characters in my game so far have all been kind of artificial to some extent. But I think it was this realization that I wrote about a robot in order to find a different way of writing about humans. And I think that felt like with Citizen Sleeper 2 that I had the opportunity to maybe deepen that a little bit and to maybe just bring a little bit of that almost subtext or kind of like the way in which sleepers relate to people's experiences, to just kind of it sharpen that a little bit and to find moments also where that kind of discussion could maybe come into the game rather than be necessarily outside the game, that the game could somehow contain a little bit of characters speaking with the sleeper and the sleeper speaking with other sleepers about what does it mean to be a sleeper and what does it mean to be a person and how do we understand humans in a kind of structural sense rather than just a kind of physical sense.
You think more moving from the subtext to the actual text?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, that's not exactly right because that sounds like I kind of take the allegorical aspects and push and just literally say them, and that's not really what I'm looking for. But I guess it was just about feeling like there's places where a sleeper can go, things I can do with a sleeper that are exciting and interesting, like having people recognize the sleeper, having a sleeper meet another sleeper, and playing out those moments and kind of the emotional resonance of that. And having, this time around, we have a character who was using she, her pronouns in the first game, Bliss, and now uses they, them pronouns and is going through a transition themselves. To be able to have a discussion between a non-binary person and a sleeper and just explicitly have that discussion just felt like a really interesting opportunity to be able to to be discursive rather than necessarily try to put something didactic in the game, but to try and like actually have these discussions play out because of the interesting position of what a sleeper is.
What I love about this game and this series is that, you know, there are so many pieces in it that I feel like as your life as a person in the world in 2025 or any time you play it in the future, you know, you can just pick up on these little threads. And I'm curious about being the personal story writing aspect of this for you, like how much of, your experience over the last couple of years has shaped the way that this game is versus how where you were a couple of years ago when you wrote the first one and the DLC.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of core things, I think. There's a kind of combination of things this time around. Obviously, making a sequel, again, like there's this kind of part ownership of the audience now when you make something and then you put it in the world and people tell you what it meant to them. It's very hard to turn around and say, well, I'm just going to make sure that isn't in the sequel, right? Like you want to include what it means to people. And so I think with the sequel, there was a bit more of that. But I think there was some core aspects that from my own life that influenced the game. I think the two main things really for me was I wanted to explore ideas of solidarity and kind of found family in a way that I think had gone through, I'd experienced in my life. So I live in London and I am very lucky to be able to kind of stay in London. A lot of people I know who used to live in London can't afford to live in London anymore or for various reasons have left. We don't have family in London, and me and my partner, we have a daughter. And so a lot of our life is kind of like stuck together from people who kind of help us with things, and we need to ask people for support. And we need, you know, a lot of backup from other people for our lives to work. And in exchange, we kind of try to offer a lot of support for other people, and our house is kind of constantly seems to have people coming and going and staying, and we like it like that. And I think that experience and the kind of, yeah, that way of being in the world is something that I felt like I wanted to explore in a game, especially moving on from Citizen Sleeper, which really wasn't kind of drawing on my experiences at the time when I was making the game, but experiences from when I was much younger, in my early 20s and in London. And so I wanted to kind of explore maybe some more of those experiences where you're more tied up into a structure. In Citizen Sleeper 1, you're kind of free-floating a little bit, and then you have this... You can look around for aid and you can get connected to different people. But in Citizen Sleeper 2, I really wanted you to be already in the world already have, you know, Seraphim, someone who needs you, and already have relationships you have to negotiate. You can't just have no relationships. They're already there, and you already have a ship, which is something of value, and that means people want things from you. And so that I wanted players to be in that complex situation. I think the other main thing that really influenced it was I had this idea for a long time that Citizen Sleeper 2, even before I was really convinced I was going to make it, would begin with you waking up from this reboot. And I think that's because many years ago I had a surgery, and I remember the experience of waking up from surgery very viscerally. And I think that waking up from surgery is such an unusual experience because you wake almost without a body. You kind of like wake into your body over like an extended period in a weird way. Like it takes hours and then also like days and weeks, to some extent. And for me, that felt like a very rich, experience to draw on when I was thinking about sleepers. And then it just so happened that I actually, unfortunately, had to have surgery twice during, Citizen Sleeper 2's development. And I think that only kind of further sharpened the fact that I'd begun with this theme of kind of being at tension with your body and the unknowability of your body and the way that the kind of contradiction that it is you, it is undeniably you and you cannot exist without your body, but at the same time you do not know what is happening in your body or what it's doing or what it's saying most of the time. And so yeah, that I think that became sharpened through my experiences, and I think that in the end became the kind of central emotional structure of Citizen Sleeper 2, is this kind of contending with the entropy of bodies, contending with the fact that we know that everything falls apart eventually, and trying to deal with that within a context where maybe everything already fell apart once already, you know, in the Helion system. So yeah, I think that became really a kind of a rich set of memories and experiences to draw on for me.
I think one of the, like, my favorite little quests is actually one where you go to find Seraphim's sibling, basically, in one of the worlds that you visit in your ship, and you realize, and I'm hearing immediately as you're talking about that found family and those places where community is kind of built on top of that, that feels like almost like a direct part of that. And I'm curious about in that particular situation, you know, the roles of people who are, you know, bound by certain relationships, and that changes over time. And can you tell me a little bit more about, I guess, people who are like blood relatives, and then the people who become more than that for family who are not related blood? Because that seemed like an interesting contrast for me, for someone who is playing through that particular quest.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's just thinking about when I'm writing, I just want to draw on the richest possible kind of like veins of thought and experience that I've either witnessed in other people's lives or that I've witnessed in my own life. I'm really looking with Citizen Sleeper games and my games more generally for what I think I've come to term like a kind of emotional realism. Like the games themselves are not realistic, but I really want them to feel real in an emotional sense. And I want the player to be able to recognize the kind of emotional experience that they go through in the real world. And so I think having the opportunity to draw on a kind of familial relationship that is maybe not necessarily very close, but has a lot of like complexity in Seraphim's relationship with his sister and carries a lot of weight. I think for me, it was just about, that's a really rich thing to draw on in that scene. And I was thinking about that scene, you know, often when I write a character and I write a plot, I have one or two scenes in my head that are kind of, they're almost the reason the plot exists. They're kind of like, they're the thing I'm thinking about and I want to get the player there. And so I think this, the tensions around kind of like, quote unquote, rescuing or helping, there's a kind of like funny crossover with Seraphim and his sister, at least that's what I intended to write, which is kind of like about who is helping who and who needs help, who needs to be rescued. And then also about the difficulties of communication, I think, that can often happen within a family where there's so much weight and history and it's so complex to try to speak clearly with family, I think. And I think that was, those were the kind of things that I wanted to draw on, is kind of like have that experience, and then also have that experience through a character that the player maybe has, depending on the player, has a different emotional relationship to, and therefore they have a kind of, it's something that I play a lot with in Citizen Sleeper, is the fact that the sleeper's always kind of on the outside of even their own personal relationships. There's always that slight disconnect that I think allows the player to inhabit a slightly more observational position than maybe in a traditional RPG, that they're often can witness scenes, and I'm not necessarily giving them in the text, like you can get right in there, and but I'm asking for the player to kind of like watch and think and narrate in their own mind, and make decisions about how they feel about it and how their character feels about it, but from a position of kind of slight distance rather than necessarily being in the middle of it, making the kind of core this is wrong, this is right decision.
I mean, one thing that really struck me when I was playing the sequel was I kind of thought back and felt actually the first game was kind of lonely in many parts. And this, as you said, sort of starts and you've got someone with you straight away, and that community builds as you go along. And I'm really curious how, you know, you've taken and included all these extra characters and sort of, you know, gameplay wise incentivize you to try and build this community out and build the ship out. You know, tell me about some of those things that you wanted to add, and was it a function of, okay, I wanted to change the gameplay and I'll make the characters work that way, or was it sort of, let's include more characters and how can we include them in the game rather than just having them sit in conversation?
So I think part of making the sequel for me was that I love the kind of ship and crew Firefly, Farscape type story. And I've always, this would like one of my first loves in life is those kind of stories. And I don't think I would ever get around to making one of those. If I would, for me, it's a genre it's very genre based, and I'm not necessarily looking to make incredibly genre based things, like things that feel like they play into a very clear paradigm, right? I find myself wanting to question and upturn and flip those things on their heads. But it felt to me like Citizen Sleeper, a Citizen Sleeper version of one of those stories, seemed like a really productive opportunity to explore that space without having to kind of sacrifice some of the things that I wanted to achieve in games. So it's like, okay, well, this is a really interesting design space. And it's also a design space that I don't think games have necessarily got right very often. And so I wanted to kind of play about with what could you do to play in that space. And one of the first principles of Citizen Sleeper when I was making it was that all of the characters should have agency. I wanted the NPCs to have a huge amount of agency and for you not to feel like you could move them around, but that they moved in the world independently of you. And I think that's one of my concerns about how games often deal with ship and crew stories, is they often have very instrumentalized characters. So the thing that I tried to do with Citizen Sleeper 2 is try to think about ways in which, if you have a ship and you have a crew, how could that crew be given more agency than they're traditionally given? So immediately thinking about, you know, giving up on, well, everyone just stays in the ship and you can go around and talk to them whenever you like. So that was immediately something where I was like, well, that's not something that ever happens in Citizen Sleeper. We never have that in Citizen Sleeper 1. I'm never, you know, it's a funny thing. Players always want that, but there's a dilution effect of giving people that. When, you know, thinking about Citizen Sleeper, all those scenes you have with characters, all of those scenes mean something. If I give you a load of scenes that don't mean anything, that are just kind of shooting the breeze, that might work for a certain kind of game, but for Citizen Sleeper, that's almost against the principles. So for me, inventing and bringing those characters into the ship and the crew was about trying to walk this, what felt like a very tight tightrope between giving you a crew and that crew having a use in the game and that crew not feeling instrumentalized. And I'm not 100% sure. People will have to tell me whether or not that design worked for them or not. And I think, you know, that I've heard all kinds of different opinions about how the crew works in Citizen Sleeper and how people feel about it. But for me, that was the objective, and that's what I was looking for. And I was also looking for ways to use the crew actions, the dice rolls that the crew have in contracts to help you narrate a relationship with crew that I couldn't necessarily provide through kind of endless scenes, like I was saying. It's quite similar to the first game, you know. I hear people make comments like, oh, I loved spending hours speaking with Emphis in Citizen Sleeper 1 or whatever. And it's like, well, there is an hour's worth of conversation with Emphis. But the kind of gameplay, the dice rolls, all of this creates a sense of scenes that you don't see, that the player invents in their mind. When they place a dice in babysitting with Mina, in their mind, they think of a babysitting scene that never occurs in the game, right? It's only ever suggested that. And so for me, that's what I was kind of honing in on the contracts, is wanting to have scenes outside of the contracts with the crew, where the crew gave you a really clear idea of who they are as a person and how they might react to things. And then when you're in a contract and you're assigning dice, we have these little barks that kind of are there to like assist storytelling. They're there so that when you tell Junie that she should like cut through a piece of hull plate, even though Junie's mostly a hacker, that Junie's response to that maybe helps like create a mini narrative that's occurring within the contract. So that was kind of my idea, that I could bring the crew to life in the player's mind without having to necessarily have them always waiting to be, you know, almost delved for information, as you sometimes find in games, this kind of feeling that you're just going to someone and asking them every option in the dialogue tree until they basically don't exist as a person anymore because they're just an exhausted menu. So that's what I was trying to avoid.
I've played plenty of games where it says you must talk to this character by chapter 3, otherwise you won't unlock the romance options and things like that. And that doesn't feels just like objectivization of those, of that whole relationship. What I'm curious about, and you talked about this a little bit at the beginning about some of those mechanics, when we first had you on the show, we were talking about the clocks, the dice placement of all of those bits, in each of those moments, the weight of spending energy in order to balance those particular challenges as well. And I'm curious, from your perspective, you said that there were a few things that you wanted to include from tabletop games that you weren't able to include in the previous games and DLC. And so can you explain for us some of the things, you know, crew being part of them, but other bits and pieces that you wanted to include from the world of tabletop games into Citizen Sleeper 2?
Yeah, so I think the main one that I was super desperate to get in, and I almost thought about kind of adding a bigger DLC to Citizen Sleeper 1 to get it in, was this kind of stress system that we have in Citizen Sleeper 2. And in a way, that's really at the heart of me beginning work on the sequel. One of the first things I did was I just created that system in Citizen Sleeper 1 and then tried playing Citizen Sleeper 1 with the Citizen Sleeper 2 stress system. The way it works is that essentially you accrue stress based on negative outcomes. And the higher your stress gets, the larger the number of die faces that will cause you damage is. So like if you have 2 stress, you roll a 1, you will take damage to that dice, directly to the dice rather than to your health or anything like this, which is kind of representative of your body. And if you get more stress, let's say you have like 5, 6, 7 stress, then maybe everything, if you roll a 1, a 2, a 3, or a 4, you're going to take damage on that dice. And so it's a kind of intentional spiraling system. It's a kind of exponential curve because it's very easy for it to accidentally get out of hand. And the thing that I love about that began me down this kind of path was looking at stress systems from things like tabletop game called Mothership or Blades in the Dark, another tabletop game, is the way in which stress is this wonderfully abstract like harm. One of the difficulties like with Citizen Sleeper 1 was the abstraction of the dice allows you to have the player do almost any action and it to be a tactical or interesting decision, right? Whether that's talking to somebody or working in a job or babysitting, it's all done with the dice. But it's often hard to find consequences that are interesting from that. And so the idea behind the stress system is you can take stress from almost any kind of action. And I like the way that in systems I was looking at, stress wasn't a harm, but it was a potential harm. It was something that you could get away with getting high and get it, or you might not get away with having even just a small amount of it. And it's very unpredictable. And so as a system, it seemed really ripe for digging into this idea of a kind of unpredictable or unknowable body that is damaged or malfunctioning and kind of you're working with. Stress seemed like a really nice paradigm for this, and especially the rolling to take damage And became part of a design that for me was about kind of asking the player to push their luck. I mean, you literally have a skill called push where you take stress to get a bonus. And it's up to the player to kind of like configure and calculate whether or not it's worth pushing or whether or not they push. And that's totally viable. I think it's totally viable to play the game and never push. And it's totally viable to play the game and push all the time because you've got a kind of build that you've worked out. So I think this was something that just felt like it was richer and that could draw out some ideas from tabletop games. So this kind of stress mechanic was a primary one. I think other things that I took from tabletop was the structure of the game. So this want to have a kind of uptime, downtime kind of structure where you go out on a high intensity experience and then you come back and you kind of have this more chill recovery period where you maybe have more narrative occurring. That for me felt really nicely matched with the kind of episodic Firefly, Farscape, Star Trek kind of like structure that I wanted in the game as well. So I felt like there was just a natural marrying there as well. And also would create this more nuanced or more complex arc of difficulty where a player can kind of like get themselves in trouble on a job and come back and then have to recover from that. And that becomes a kind of story. But it means that then the next time they go on a job, it creates this really interesting relation between jobs and this really, you know, what I'm always looking for is, even though I'm telling a story and I really want to tell that story with my games, is I'm wanting the player to add to that story and to contribute to it all the time. So that contract structure gives, again, the player a kind of something that happens in tabletop games as well, where it's like players think to themselves, oh, well, that last job went really bad. And do you remember that job that went so bad and we all almost died? And then, oh, but this one's gone so easy. It creates this really nice way of marking time and creating a kind of pattern. So that seemed like a really valuable thing to pull over. So those were the kind of like core things that I was really, really eager to draw on from to tabletop this time around.
Is there an invisible hand of design behind some of the moments that you're in? Because I know that I got into some pretty dicey scrapes and I'm just wondering how much do you influence what happens versus is it just pure luck in many of these circumstances?
It's funny how often people think that I might be cheating the dice rolls. You know what it is?
Especially when you get good dice rolls too. Like, you know, you might be thinking, yeah, here we go. I'm in a really dire spot and I get the clutch dice roll I need.
So, I mean, this is to me, so I did a PhD in experimental narrative. And my PhD was mostly around classifying how narrative occurs within experimental work. The reason I mention this is because the human brain has a way of narrativizing absolutely everything. And that's how we live. You know, we have a random series of events that happen to us in a day and we turn them into a story. And I think this is a really strong vision of narrative I have in my head. So I think dice, there's a reason we use dice in tabletop games so much. And that's because they have this incredible ability to tell a story. You know, if you roll, even if you just roll three threes in a row, that seems like it means something to somebody. It can always mean something. There's kind of, you know, and that's a relatively innocuous dice roll. While if you roll like a six and then you roll a one or roll a 20 and then roll a one, you know, those things, they create a narrative. And so for me, I'm looking for that effect on the player. In terms of me having an invisible hand of design, what I do is I give... The stress design is so effective to me because it asks the player to set their limit. So if you're a cautious player, you might try to avoid taking any stress at all, but you will feel tense, you know, because you're a cautious person. Any bit of stress, you'll be like, oh God, no, I've got a bit of stress now. I'm really worried about it. If you're not as cautious a player, you might be like, oh, this stress thing's easy. I've clocked it straight away. I don't take damage. That will inherently involve you then like pushing your luck a little more, and you will naturally slot into your kind of tension spot. And the contracts are kind of designed around this idea that it's almost impossible for you to, there's lots of competing elements. There's the contract, it has stress, how well it's going, your crew has stress, you have your stress. It's very easy to not pay attention to one thing, which is something that I want. And it's very easy to overextend yourself very quickly. If you roll a day's worth of ones and twos and you decide to use them, that's me tempting you into getting yourself in trouble. And so I often find that people with this game feel like the game is balanced very tightly. Like they end contracts and they're like, oh, I just made it by one dice. But it's often the player who's kind of like pushing themselves into that circumstance, because the space contracts or expands depending on how much the player is willing to push. Where their kind of fear level hits is kind of where they suddenly start managing everything, and then they kind of keep it down and they kind of ride it out. But, you know, on the flip side, we only, you know, the lowest, apart from the glitch dice, the lowest dice in the game are a coin flip. That's a fairly good chance. And that is me asking you to get yourself in trouble, is because I know if I give you less than a 50-50 chance, you're probably not going to take it. But if I give you a 50-50 chance, there's always a possibility. So, yeah, I really try to play on people's expectations and, you know, own narratives around their own luck and how willing they are to push themselves towards tension in order to hopefully achieve that. Almost everybody, hopefully everybody who plays Lucid and Sleeper has at least one moment where they're like, oh my God, it's gone horribly wrong.
I had a few of those, definitely. I was definitely sitting and I was pushing as much as I possibly could. And I came down to a few where I was like, you know, all the bars are red, a few dice are gone, and I'm like in a lot of trouble here, but you still managed to get through at the end. And I thought, oh, here we go. So I'm curious, like, you know, you've obviously given this a lot of thought. You've spent a lot of time now in taking another look at the world of Citizen Sleeper and evolving that game. But is there more Citizen Sleeper stories you want to tell, more styles of game that you'd like to explore in this universe, or have you kind of reached the point with this series?
Yeah, so I mean, Citizen Sleeper 2, for the time being, is the last Citizen Sleeper video game. It was kind of my opportunity to like put forward everything that I wanted to do within the world. So I tried to get that all in, and I tried to also work towards an ending that I felt would almost be an ending for the first game and the second game. Not that it has a finality to it, but that more that it kind of like tries to draw together many different pieces. It's especially nice just now, you know, we're only a couple of weeks out from launch, to kind of see the two of them kind of bundled together and see people playing them, buying them both together and then playing them in quick succession and kind of having really interesting responses to that. Because that's an experience that I haven't had, and many I don't know many people who've had. So that's a whole new experience people can have now. So I'm really happy with them as a two. I think they, especially the fact that, yeah, like I said, you know, some people prefer the first, and I really like that in a weird way. It's nice to see that discussion happening, like which do you prefer and why do you prefer it, and what different things does each game draw out from different people. I think that's really great. I'm really, you know, really happy about that. So for me, that's a, you know, definitely with the second one going so well, it's really hard to imagine going back and attempting that again, because it felt like such a tightrope walk, and it's really difficult. It's really hard to express how difficult it can be to make a sequel, because the pressure is so much more and the expectation is so different, and you're competing with yourself in a very particular way. So I'm quite happy to have achieved what I set out to do and to see that response, and then to walk away from Citizen Sleeper. I don't feel like I have a huge amount to add. On the flip side, I am kind of starting work on a tabletop version of Citizen Sleeper. That's going to kind of take me a couple of years, I think, working with a collaborator. But that's really kind of like a side project for me. I have games that I really want to make, and I have lessons that I've learned from Citizen Sleeper. And the thing with making a sequel as well is it does reduce your possibility space. You know, with each game you make, there's more and more expectations. And I think, yeah, it's quite scary to think about going back into that again. So I'm really excited now about looking at a wide open possibility space and kind of taking ideas from Citizen Sleeper that I think were effective, but then also letting them loose in a space where people don't have expectations that I have to deal with, and where actually I can present completely new structures. And I think for me, that's what's really exciting about games more generally. So I'm really looking forward to moving on and doing some new experiments.
Were you ever tempted to do a story of the sleeper before they became free? Is that something that's interesting to you? Because that's something I'm curious about, but is it better to leave that blank spaces in the map?
I guess, yeah, for me, there are so many places where you could tell different stories in Citizen Sleeper, you know, that, and I think that's why a tabletop game is quite attractive to me, because I'm interested in giving, you know, if you wanted to tell that story, that you could tell, give you the tools to tell that story, because there are so many stories. Citizen Sleeper is very intentionally made to have that potential. When I first made the game, I wanted to think about something that would have a lot of potential for additional things to be added to it and additional stories. And I've been very, I guess I've been quite strict on myself in terms of not introducing too, not mining too many of those elements, unless I really felt like they fit. So within Citizen Sleeper 2, for example, you meet a sleeper, another sleeper for the first time. And that's something that I thought about having in Citizen Sleeper 1, but I wanted to hold back on. And that's something that kind of comes in Citizen Sleeper 2. So I'm always really careful to introduce these elements because I want them to be fully realized. So a story about a sleeper who is yet to escape is 100% something that I would love to explore. But it's, like you say, there's, you need these blank spots on the map. And I think science fiction in general, you know, I remember growing up and watching Star Wars and Obi-Wan Kenobi says, you know, I fought with your father in the Clone Wars, right? And now the jury is out whether or not filling in that particular gap was worthwhile or not. But I think there's something that I've always loved about science fiction, and especially the science fiction I read when I was growing up, which is that it always has those kind of gaps. And I, in general, I'd say I'm quite attracted to video games and science fiction for the same reasons, which is their kind of inherently gappy nature. There's always things for you to fill in. So I think it's very unlikely that I would want to go and like just fill in all those gaps and tell the complete story. But it's definitely, the space is out there. I guess the thing is, as Citizen Sleeper moves away from video games, I'm not against doing other projects within Citizen Sleeper universe, but the question is just whether the opportunities are there and the collaborators are there to make them worthwhile.
What do you think the next video game you'll make will be, or are you working on at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not working on it, but I'm definitely know exactly what it is. I have a really clear picture actually in my head. It's a game that I the first ideas of part of it came from years before I even started making video games, and it's kind of been bouncing around in my head for a long time. It's one I've been holding on to for a long time and just kind of waiting very patiently till the moment where I felt like it was right to make it. And I actually pitched it to Fellow Traveler before making Citizen Sleeper 2, and then I went back to them a few weeks later and said, no, I don't want to make this right now. Let's make Citizen Sleeper 2 instead. So it's sat there kind of waiting for me. But at the moment, I'm kind of enjoying having launched the game. It's like not fully locking into another multi-year process. So I'm kind of, my main focus now is just on letting my brain kind of like wander around the gardens of this idea, just kind of like smelling the roses a bit, seeing if something interesting comes up, just kind of going back to all of the things that inspired it, rereading them, rewatching them, and just letting it really bed in so that when I do come to start work on it, the foundations are super strong. So that's where I'm kind of at right now.
Well, I can't wait to have you back on in a couple of years when that is out in the world and talk to you once again. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Lightmap.
Thanks so much.
Join the Sifter community on Discord at sifter.com.au/Discord.
You can find Citizen Sleeper now. It's out everywhere on anything you'd like to play it on, pretty much. Just head to the link in the show notes where you'll find more information and play the game. And yeah, if you haven't played the first one, definitely pick them both up as one of those packs and play them together. One of my favorite games of the year when it came out that year. So this has been Lightmap, Sifter's interview podcast. Sifter is produced by myself, Fiona Bartholomaeus, Kyle Paletto, Courtney Smith, Adam Christou, and Chris Button. Mitch Lowe is our senior producer and also edits these episodes. And my name is Gianni DiGiovanni. I'm Sifter's executive producer. Thanks to Audio Technica Australia and Apple for their support of Sifter. If you'd like to share the show, you can leave us a comment, or you can send the video on, or leave a rating and review on your favorite player, wherever you've been listening to this. That really makes a difference. Even just texting it to your friends, sending them to Discord, that is a really good thing you can do to support independent creators and get people's these conversations out there for other people to enjoy. That's all the time we have for now. Until next time, have fun.